This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with an av geek who is passionate about sharing the stories of vintage aviation, and he has a plan to do that. In the news, an electric airplane company closes up. The FAA publishes a new ADS-B pre-flight policy. The massive GE9X engine gets Guinness Book of World Records recognition. Commercial aviation is in the environmentalist crosshairs. The latest on DB Cooper, a rebranding of the 737 MAX, or maybe not, and a hotel room with a full flight simulator. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 561 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's the 2008 CFI of the Year, and of course, he is an expert, maybe the expert, on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Hi, Max.
Hey, you forgot to mention, I'm also good friends with that guy, Max Flight. I got to tell you, it is so great to be here with you. This is something I look forward to every week, is getting to hang out with you. So, hello.
Oh, yes. And we're having fun, too. We've been having fun for quite a few minutes. Boy, look what time it is. Boy, we've been having more fun than we should have been having before the show started.
But well, let the show go on.
Our guest this episode is Mart Klupper. Mart was raised around aviation. His father was a pilot for United Airlines, who loved tail draggers, sailplanes, and skydiving, and that rubbed off on Mart. And he also developed a bit of an interest in aircraft restoration, a few other activities. His newest project is a high-quality print magazine to be called Vintage Aviation. Mart, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, hey, thank you very much. Thrilled to be here.
I should say welcome back, because Mark previously appeared on Airplane Geeks way back in episode 260, and way, way back, get ready for this, in episode 33. Boy, that was, wow. we were little kids back then, Mark.
Yeah, well, I wondered, because it's interesting. I'd forgotten that I was on two episodes. So, because I thought when you mentioned that first one, I thought, oh, well, I thought it was earlier than that in your. And so, sure enough, though, 33, did you say, was the?
Yes.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Hard to fathom. So, what are you, besides your project that we're going to talk about here coming up, Vintage Aviation? Are you doing much flying these days?
Well, not as much as I'd like, for sure. And that's kind of an interesting thing, because I guess I'm a little bit of a snob. I don't really think of myself as a snob, but I'm so passionate about older airplanes and tail draggers and unique airplanes that if I can't fly that, I'm not so compelled to go fly a Cherokee or a 172. Not that there's anything wrong with those, for sure. I mean, it just, but for me, I'm not really drawn to that so much. So I tend to wait until I have the opportunity to fly the things that I am actually passionate about, you know. And again, it sounds snobbish, and I don't mean it to be that way. It's just sort of the way I am, and it has a lot to do with the airplanes I was raised around as a kid. I was just always around something really unique, and so that's the coat that fits good to me, you know, is the odd or unusual or old airplanes and things like that. So I just recently got my flight review again, because I had been lacking currency for about 6 months, and I went out to California to the Super Cub that I had restored recently. And to help with the annual, because the airplane's now been done for a year, and I was able to get my flight review in that airplane again. So that was awesome.
Nice, nice. Didn't you used to fly, what were those called? You know, the open air, no cockpit, essentially.
What, the Breezy?
The Breezy, yes. Yes. Used to fly, have you flown in the Breezy?
I have not flown a Breezy in a long, long time. However, my half-brother, who owns the Super Cub out there in California, just recently bought a home-built baby Ace airplane. So it's a single-seat, high-wing, open cockpit. So it's not like the Breezy with no cockpit, but it's an open cockpit. And he was actually going to let me borrow the airplane for a year or two. And I was going to fly it back from California to Indiana over the Rockies. And I actually headed out on that trip. And then I had an oil leak. And so I turned around and went back. And the short story is I just didn't fly the airplane back this time. So maybe I'll be able to do that in the future. But it's an open cockpit airplane. And boy, I tell you, it's just so cool to fly an open cockpit, or in the case of the Breezy, a no cockpit airplane. And so I did get 5 hours in that baby Ace like a month ago or so, which was wonderful. Really enjoyed it.
Max, have you flown an open cockpit at all?
Ooh, you know what? I've been in a Stearman. I guess that qualifies.
Yeah, that would qualify.
Yeah, because I have not. Yeah, I definitely want. Yeah, that's on my bucket list to fly in a Stearman or something of that sort, a biplane, an open cockpit biplane. That feels like something that I really have to do.
You should. I treated myself for my birthday 1 year to 1.3 hours of dual in a Stearman and had my video camera with me. That was before the days of the iPhone. And oh my gosh, that was just so much fun. The pilot loved aerobatics, so we did at least one loop and a roll, and it was just a real kick. I had a great time.
Yeah, I've got to try that. Well, let's do a little bit of aviation news from the past week. We should get started with that. Are you guys ready?
Ready from the West.
Let's do it.
Our first item comes from the Seattle Times. I always want to say brothel when I read this. Bothell-based, is that right? Bothell? Bothell-based electric airplane startup Zunum runs out of cash. You may recall that we had Mike Knapp, the founder of Zunum Aero, on the podcast episode 453. Zunum, of course, was looking to, they call it democratize access to high-speed travel through hybrid electric regional airplanes. Well, Max T, sounds like Zunum has not been able to achieve that objective.
Well, not yet. I mean, I guess it remains to be seen whether or not they'll be able to figure out how to work their way out of this. This article, by the way, is written by Dominic Gates, who we've also had on the show here multiple times, an aviation reporter. And I was kind of struck by it for a couple reasons. One, there were some pretty large companies helping to fund them. So both Boeing and Airbus apparently had provided funding, perhaps through their venture capital sides. I'm not quite sure.
And JetBlue.
Oh, and JetBlue as well. Okay, great. And they had projected that it was going to cost them right around $37 million to complete this. But apparently they have laid off most of their 70-person staff already, which is never a good sign when that happens. So it looks like they are very much out of cash. They'd also announced that a private jet charter company was going to be their launch customer, and they were looking to inaugurate service in 2023. Now, this was a 12-passenger hybrid electric aircraft. And I think why this is really notable is there are so many companies which are proposing electric aircraft that you and I have talked about how undoubtedly there's going to be a lot of wreckage along the roadway to electric aircraft. That is, probably 90% of these companies will eventually fail. Whether or not Zunum has failed, we don't know. But I think it just shows that it's going to take a fairly robust business plan, some very deep pockets, and a little bit of luck to prevail in this particular market. So we wish Zunum well, but at this point, it's not looking good.
Yeah, and when you mention a little bit of luck, I think that is really kind of an important part of this. It's at times being at the right place at the right time with the right people. The stars have to align. It's not easy to bring a new airplane company online and to success. Mark, do you have any thoughts on all the talk these days about electric airplanes? And in some cases, it's more than just talk. People are producing, manufacturing, and selling electric airplanes to a certain extent. But where do you think that's headed, Mark? Any thoughts?
Well, Yeah, I'm curious about it for sure. And it seems to me like maybe we're trying to run before we can walk to a certain extent. That's sort of my view. That's not been a very, you know, deep look at the industry at this point in time. Hmm. It seems like we've got a lot of crawling to do before we're ready to be so forward thinking here. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the technology is there, or, you know, or at least the reasonable assumption of it. I don't know. It'll be kind of interesting to see. But, you know, there were several small scale electric projects in the works 10 years ago, and very few of those even succeeded. So I think it's a bigger challenge than we might think. But, you know, there's the, is it that one called the Alice? Am I thinking of the right one? This it's recently been unveiled with the electric propulsion out at the wingtips.
Hmm.
Are you familiar with that one? Have you seen it? Was at the Paris Air Show. I think it's from Israel. But anyway, it's one worth looking at and talking about, because it seems a lot of its design doesn't seem to make sense. But I guess that's one thing that we're going to see in the future here, is that these new technologies are bringing people that have an entirely different mindset into the aerospace world. And some of them are going to turn out to be kooks, but some of them are going to have innovative ideas that maybe our traditional path would not have come up with. So it might be pretty fascinating to see what really does transpire in the next 5 or 10 years.
That's a really interesting observation, Mart. I think that, you have the same people look at the same problems for years and years, and everybody tends to look at things the same way.
Right.
And yeah, those outside eyes can bring a new creativity or a perspective that, you know, the old guard doesn't have. And yeah, that's true. That's what's happening with a lot of these companies. So
yeah, it'll be interesting to see for sure.
Yes, yes. Another item from this from Aviation Today: FAA publishes new 2020 ADS-B pre-flight policy. Now, this confuses me. I don't know if you guys can explain this or not, but there's something that's been published in the Federal Register by the FAA. It's called a Statement of Policy on Performance Requirements for Operators of Aircraft That Are Equipped with Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast, or ADS-B, out. The policy, I guess, identifies some circumstances where the FAA is providing assurance to operators that it won't consider degradation of GPS performance as a failing below or falling below the rule requirements if this performance condition was outside the operator's control. What does that mean?
Would you like me to jump in?
any time, because I don't know what this means.
Yeah. So I wrote my first article on ADS-B out back when I was a columnist for EAA's magazine, Sport Aviation, and I had a whole column on ADS-B back when it was new. So the ADS-B out rule mandates that all aircraft that fly in certain kinds of airspace be ADS-B compliant by January 2nd. I always thought it was January 1st, but I just read January 2nd, 2020, which is right around the corner. And essentially, ADS-B out is a system that has two major components. One is a WASC-capable GPS receiver so that the aircraft can determine its position extremely precisely. And the other is a transponder, which will transmit that position to both ground stations, radar stations, other aircraft, things like that. There is an interesting little exemption that I first learned of almost 2 years ago when the House held its hearings on privatization. And in one of those hearings, one of the representatives who was questioning people mentioned that the airlines had an exemption for the ADS-B out policy, which all of us who knew heard that said, "Really? What's that?"
And the exemption
essentially was that they could get by for a while with a GPS receiver that was non-WASC capable, which means it's less accurate and therefore wouldn't give, you know, its position as precisely as a WASC capable receiver would. And essentially, airlines had to apply for this, and the intent was that if they had older aircraft, that they wouldn't be able to upgrade in time
that they would still be allowed to fly. And essentially what this is saying is for those people who are covered by that for those airlines that are covered by that exemption or those operators, that they will have to do something extra since they've been allowed to fly with this non-compliant equipment. They're going to have to do something extra from a pre-flight planning basis that other aircraft won't have to do, and they're going to have to run specific software that looks at the positioning of GPS satellites to figure out how good the accuracy is going to be during their flight. So it's basically they have to run the software tool to make sure that even though they're using an older GPS, that they will still have accuracy of less than 0.2 nautical miles, which is not very good, actually, by GPS standards. And I got to tell you, those of us who first heard about this exemption for the airlines were outraged. It's like, what do you mean? You're telling people that own a $20,000 Cessna 152, they have to put this in there, but the airline can't afford to put this stuff in. So it's still, to me, it's kind of a sweetheart deal, I think, with industry. Surely they could have afforded to put the new equipment in time, but they've been given a bit of a pass, I would say.
Hmm. WAAS is what, WAAS? That's a GPS based.
So it's the Wide Area Augmentation System, which is essentially in the U.S. It's a network of roughly 40 ground stations scattered throughout all of North America, which measure errors of GPS signals at those locations on the ground. And then from that, they impute what the different air components must be in the satellite's position error, its timing error, the errors as a signal passes through the ionosphere, and all those corrections for each of those errors is then transmitted on a separate set of geosynchronous satellites that are received only by WAAS-capable receivers, and they apply those corrections to the basic GPS signal, and that gives them an extremely accurate position.
So is that more or less accurate than my cell phone?
I was going to say, by the way, would you have guessed I've written a book on this subject?
Yeah, I know. This is great. This is good. Yeah. I mean, I thought my cell phone GPS was plus or minus 9 feet or something.
Yeah, and so what they really are looking for is what is going to be the kind of the 99.9%, will not exceed this type of accuracy. You may have that kind of accuracy most of the time, but you can imagine most of the time is not a criteria that airlines like to, base things on. So yeah, WAAS is going to guarantee that you've got extremely good accuracy and that never gets bad, even under, extreme conditions. And so WAAS is one of three SBAS systems, SBAS, and there are others in other parts of the world. So there's one in Europe and one, I think, in Russia. Cognos is the name of one of them. I don't recall the other one.
Wow. Mark, do you have anything that needs to be ADS-B compliant by 2020?
No. In fact, the way I fly and the way I like to fly, it's a non-issue for me, really. I'm kind of the old school that way. And I enjoy not going to the kind of airspace that would require that.
Okay.
And the difference is I live right in the heart of the kind of airspace that requires it. So, yeah, it would be really nice not to have to deal with the complexity that we have around here. But, some folks have to deal with it.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, well, let's talk jets. Let's talk jet engines. So, a topic that I get a little more conversant in, I guess. This is GE9X sets world record as most powerful jet engine. Now, the GE9X is the engine for the Boeing 777X, and it's been officially declared by the Guinness Book of World Records as the most powerful jet engine, producing 134,300 pounds of thrust. Now, this is actually not a new event. This was produced during an engineering test in November 2017, but GE chose to announce the record this month, I think, as part of their 100-year celebration. Yeah, this is a big milestone year for GE. And in fact, we're working on lining up a guest in the coming weeks that can tell us a lot about General Electric and its 100-year history. This is a big motor. The previous record was the GE90-115B, and that powers the 777-300ER, and that was 127,900 pounds of thrust that ran during a test run in 2002. Now, it's worth noting that these are not the ratings for the engine. This is just the maximum thrust achieved on a test stand. The rating is somewhat lower. In fact, the GE9X is, I think, rated to 105,000 pounds of thrust. So you can ask the question, well, if it's only rated to 105,000, what's this 134 for? Well, it's margin, but it's also margin that allows future variants that may be heavier. Typically, when an engine is designed for, and it always is the case for a particular aircraft, for a particular application, as we know, there are stretch versions, there are other changes that end up requiring increased thrust. So the engine maker is not going to design it strictly for the minimum. But this is a big, big, big motor.
I was really, really struck by that as I looked at the photos here. First, I noticed kind of from the front-on view, the cross-section, there you can see a couple of people standing in the picture. And I would say this engine is probably about three times, you know, larger or higher, if you will. In other words, you could stand just about three people on top of each other to go across the diameter of this engine. But then what really stunned me was this photo down below, where they show a side view of what the engine looks like compared to the fuselage of a 737.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me. This engine is bigger than the fuselage of a 737. I mean, that is just a huge engine.
GE has used some advanced technologies in this engine. It makes use of some ceramic matrix composites in the high-pressure turbine, and I think in a few other places. It's also the engine that is causing the 777X program to be delayed somewhat. They are having some kind of an issue with the engine. They were hoping to fly the 777X earlier, but now it looks like year end is going to see the first flight. And just to give you another way to see the size comparison, is we'll put a video in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com. It's an engine run-up to full power of the GE9X engine mounted on GE Aviation's 747 test aircraft. So this is really telling, because you see three engines that represent the size of an engine for a 747, and then you see the fourth engine on the wing being this large GE9X, and the difference is quite impressive. Mart, I understand the 747, that was your father's favorite plane, aircraft of choice, maybe.
Absolutely, it was. Let me go back real quick to what you were just talking about, because it looks like a cartoon engine on that 747 testbed.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculously large. It's amazing. But it kind of reminds me of when I was a kid, because when I was about 10 years old is when my dad went to 747 school at United, and he came online with the airplane shortly after it came online with the airline, so early in its career. And these were the early 747s, of course, and they had the Pratt & Whitney JT9D engine on it, which for its day was really kind of comparable to this. It was like nothing we'd ever seen before for the size and such. And what I remember, a lot of the promotional pictures, they'd have, whether it be a pilot or just a person or even a stewardess, standing inside the nacelle and maybe reaching up and able to touch the top of the nacelle, but it was huge, you know. And then now look at this one, significantly larger than the entire cross section of a 737 fuselage. It's just unbelievable to see how much things have changed that way. But yeah, my dad was absolutely in love with the 747, and he got over 10,000 hours total time as a co-pilot, and then eventually got enough seniority to just switch seats and become a captain. He spent 16 years flying that airplane. And yeah, he just absolutely loved it.
Nice. These things are often measured, at least by the engine guys, in terms of the fan diameter. And the GE9X has a fan diameter of 134 inches. By way of comparison, a 787-10 engine, 76,000 pounds of thrust, that has a 111-inch fan. The difference is just striking. But besides just being larger, they're also more efficient because GE has done some work with the combustors, some other components. So bigger, but less emissions and less fuel consumption. All right, well, let's move on. And this is an interesting article in the Washington Post. It's titled, Europe's Flight Shame Movement Doesn't Stand a Chance in the U.S. And this relates to, I guess maybe, Max, the growth or the continued growth of environmentalism when it comes to air travel and air travel becoming a bit of a target.
Yeah, it really struck me as kind of interesting. I know we've talked a little bit in the past about carbon emissions and airlines and how some of the countries around the world are reacting to that with the various types of carbon taxes. In fact, we talked about that most recently with WOW Airlines, which had a huge fine that was being levied post-bankruptcy, which means it's unlikely to be paid. But essentially what they're saying is that some of the folks are really starting to try and flight shame people who are taking airline travel in Europe, which is kind of interesting. They mentioned that France has announced an eco tax of anywhere from about $2 to $20 per flight that's going to be used to finance other forms of transportation, including train travel. I think the idea being that these are more eco-friendly and don't put as much carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere. And experts, of course, are saying that this may start to become more prevalent in Europe, but it seems unlikely that it's going to take hold in the U.S., and I would totally agree. I've been lucky enough to be in Europe a number of times, sometimes on business, sometimes for pleasure travel. And what I can say is that, in general, the density of the population there is much, much, much greater than it is on average here in the United States. And so it's much more cost effective to put rail service in and have kind of universal rail systems. When I was in, I think, both Germany and Austria, it seemed like their goal was to make sure that virtually every village would have some type of mass transportation that would connect to every other village, in the country. And we just don't have that here in the United States, because even though we have, massive population centers, we have massive distances between those centers that are virtually empty. And you see that as you fly from coast to coast on an airline. You especially see that if you fly at lower altitudes in a small airplane. I mean, it certainly seems at times like this country is incredibly crowded, but I assure you, this country is essentially empty by many measures.
Yeah. If I could join in on that discussion a little bit, because my dad was a pilot for United and my parents got divorced when I was young, I spent a fair amount of time riding the airliner across the country to go visit the other one. And so I remember being taught in school, this was in my younger years, around 10 to 14, about how the population explosion was a problem. We're running out of room. And I'm thinking, you sit on an airliner for 4 hours between Chicago and San Francisco, and 98% of what you see is open land. And so it just didn't ring very true to me, some of those particular concerns. So I see these kinds of stories. I question the motives ultimately. And I'm kind of a skeptic when it comes to a lot of these kinds of issues. And I really question the motives of these kinds of actions, to be honest.
I think a takeaway for me is that even if we believe or convince ourselves or even prove with data that it's not an issue, or it's not an issue here, or it shouldn't be an issue here, anything like that, that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be these other people. That sounds bad, the others. I don't really mean it in a negative way, but some people, let me put it that way. Some people who, and maybe they have an agenda that may or may not be legitimate, but doesn't matter really, that they can amass the power to put pressure on the industry in some form or another. And those other parties could include governments, not just let's call them environmentalists. It just sounds so strange for me to talk this way because I've always considered myself an environmentalist. But they could affect the industry regardless of how we feel about, you know, what they're doing or what the issue is. And so we can't just ignore it. But I don't know, you know, I don't know what we do. I mean, if you look at efficiency improvements and emissions reductions in airliners, I mean, the 737 MAX, the A320neo family, you know, all of these newer aircraft are producing far, far less emissions than the aircraft they replace. You know, the industry is doing is investing a lot of money into it, but the pressures just may become stronger than some people might like. And cause changes. I don't know. It's kind of hard to say, I guess.
It sure is interesting when you look back to the early days of the jets. Like, you guys remember what it was like seeing a 707 or a DC-8 back in the early 60s or mid 60s or something like that. And it literally became, it was like a smoke screen.
Smoky. And look at a B-52 even today, because it uses engines from that era. It produced a lot of just junk coming out the back end.
And while it is sort of comical to look at what we were doing back then, it surely wasn't the best idea back then, but we've done so much to improve. I mean, amazingly so. And so I think that ultimately the industry deserves more credit for where we are at today, instead of more beaten over the head that, you know, somehow we're ruining the planet with these turbine engines. So that's kind of my view.
Yeah.
Is that we've gone so far forward from the old days.
And yes, I think that ties in well with the point I was poorly trying to make. I think that it may be important to not just rest on our laurels, you know, in the industry, that we've made all of these advancements, that, you know, if we don't communicate, if others don't realize that the industry is taking some significant steps and has in the past and continues to do so, we need to do the PR that gets that word out. Let's see. Well, the Boeing, the 737 MAX, there was some interesting, I don't know if you call it hubbub, but there was some interesting posts on social media having to do with a Ryanair 737 MAX 8 that was spotted.
I saw a rather interesting tweet on Twitter from someone well known to the show, Rob Mark. He said that there was a photo that appeared somewhere of a Ryanair jet, and in the past, those were apparently known as 737 MAX 8s. And on the nose now, says the model number is 737-8200. So a lot of people were speculating that maybe Boeing has ditched the 737 MAX name. I subsequently found a separate article that said, not so fast, that the 737-8200 designation has been used for a couple years in various kinds of documentation, and that maybe this is not an actual rebranding. So we don't know the answer to the story, but it's certainly an interesting one. And so I think the most important ramification of this, Max, is it means you and I can hold off on our lawsuit against Boeing for tarnishing our good name.
That's right. Yeah.
So if I can, though, ask, what do you guys think about that idea of, you know, whether there's any validity to it or not, but the idea of changing the name? Do you think that's a good idea? Do you think it's something that should be done?
You know, it may become necessary. I was talking with someone today who has absolutely no interest in aviation and certainly would never know the name of the airplane they were flying on. And you ask her, let's see, what's that Boeing plane that has all those problems? Oh, the 737 MAX. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that. There's an awareness that I think is kind of unprecedented. Maybe I'm wrong, but it feels kind of unique. And since that name is now become so strongly ingrained in public consciousness, I don't know, you know, a rebranding might make some sense. except that there's no guarantee that would really achieve anything. As soon as people say, "Oh, well, the Dash 8200 is the same thing as the Max," you know, I mean, you can't really keep it a secret. So right. You know, it's hard, but you know, you still have that issue with people looking at safety cards on a 737 NG and seeing that it says Max on there and wondering, are we flying on a Max? They're petrified.
And I saw that a headline that said Southwest has just changed their safety cards, which showed multiple models, including Max. Of course, I remember being on one of their aircraft soon after the first accident, and I thought, oh my gosh, am I on a Max? And then I read the card more carefully and realized, oh, this is used for multiple different types of 737 variants at Southwest. So, yeah, I think that rebranding, if they choose to do that, actually probably will help, because a lot of people won't connect the dots. And I think in the past, when there have been issues with particular, you know, airframes or airlines, people forget pretty quickly and they, you know, jump right back on those airplanes or those airline companies. This time, the amount of bad news has been so sustained that, you know, rebranding might actually be a good thing. By the way, I just wanted to mention that when I posted I retweeted Rob's article on Twitter, and I commented about, not going forward with the lawsuit because of Boeing changing the name and not using Max anymore. And I'll give a quick shout out to a Stacy Sherman who said, "If it makes you feel any better, my dad's name was Dick."
Yeah, I saw that.
And I wrote back and said, "Actually, that makes me chuckle and smile. Thank you." So, yep. I guess I'll stick with the name Max here for a while longer.
Yeah. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal this morning that I happened to see where some insiders are now thinking that we won't see the Max return to service until January of next year, that there's so much that has to happen that it'd be kind of impossible to get through all the wickets before then. Wickets including acceptance by the FAA, by other regulatory agencies, through whatever training needs to take place before flying can resume. So the thing just seems to keep pushing out and out and out, which is, of course, disastrous.
And when this aircraft does return to service, I'm thinking it may be the only kind I ever fly again, because it's going to be so safe by the time they bring out all these issues. It's probably going to be a bulletproof airplane.
Well, that's actually a great point, and I think completely valid. It's frequent that you see a company, let's say, gets fined for violations of something, a regulation or a law or something, and you in your company want to go benchmark somebody for who's got the best practice for that particular kind of an issue, you go find that company that got the huge fines, because they're going to have figured out how to change their processes to be the most robust and reliable. So now we end up with sort of that same thing occurring with the 737. And some of the issues that they're uncovering even go back to the earlier versions of the 737, which, just makes the whole thing even more complicated and time-consuming to work out. And it doesn't really indicate to me that, these planes have been or are unsafe, but when you open it up and start to look at things, you're always going to find this little thing here that's maybe not as perfect as you might like, or that little thing there. And that's the danger of opening something up and looking inside and determining, does it meet everything to the absolute letter? Because frequently it doesn't. And I think that's what we're seeing here.
Well, I think a good analogy, and this is kind of timely because it was just 50 years ago this week that the Apollo program launched and landed on the moon. You think back to 1967 with the Apollo fire on the launch pad. Were it not for that, as tragic as it was, it probably actually made the Apollo program successful. I think there are a lot of people who feel that if that fire hadn't occurred, we wouldn't have made it to the moon, because there were so many problems that were hidden that wouldn't have been unearthed except for the massive investigation that happened afterwards. So I think this is in some ways analogous to that.
Yeah,
Yeah, the only other thought I had, too, is that I think that this kind of points to Boeing would have been smarter, I think, in the long run, had they gone ahead and created a clean sheet airplane for this role for moving forward, rather than trying to, you know, mold the 737 airframe one more time into something that, and I'm not against what they've done with the airplane. I just think that you could make the case that had they spent the money to go ahead and go clean sheet, it probably is going to work out cheaper that way than the situation they've created as it is currently.
So, yeah, as it turns out. Yeah, yeah. They of course, they were under a lot of pressure to respond to the A320neo family, and that was an issue. That's why, and I've said this many times before, I think that a lot of the success and failure, not failure, but the different levels of success, let's say, of these aviation companies rests on timing, where they are in the cycle. You know, do they have the engineering resources to develop a clean sheet of paper at this point in time, or do they have to wait until another later time? And example is the NMA. Boeing, or we all expected Boeing to have announced the NMA and be proceeding down that path by now, but of course they're not, most certainly because they're focused on the 737 MAX issue. And that, you know, that kicks the can down the road a little bit, so to speak, and that may throw them out of cycle for that class of aircraft. So timing is counts for a lot in this industry.
And to counter my thought too is that they had just come off the 787 program, which was supposed to be revolutionary in its engineering process, and in reality, it created a whole new set of problems. So they didn't necessarily have they weren't running really high on the idea of clean sheet designs, to be honest.
Yes.
Because it's just anyway. So there's so much to it, and there's no way to know when you're in the moment. Usually, you only know when you're looking back at the moment. You know what the right answers are.
So yes,
it's all pretty fascinating stuff, though.
Well, there's something else that maybe there's no way to know, and that's the story of D.B. Cooper. Remember D.B. Cooper, the guy that parachuted out the back of a Northwest Orient 727 with $200,000 in cash in 1971, never to be found again. There's been speculation over the years as to certain individuals who may have been the guy.
Yes, and I want to make it very clear here that I was a teenager at the time, so it was definitely not me who did that.
I was really beginning to wonder, so I'm glad you've clarified that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a story that I think has captured the attention of so many people for so many decades, simply because it was bold and audacious in the way it was executed, and because we just never really have known for sure what happened to D.B. Cooper. And so I was fascinated by this particular story that said that a gentleman who was considered a suspect has passed away. And as I read the story, I read things that I had never heard about this before. So this was Robert Rackshaw, who had died at the age of 75, a former Army pilot. And I think what was intriguing to me was that in later years in the investigation, somebody went back and looked at some letters that came from D.B. Cooper, one of which went to the Portland Oregonian newspaper, and they had, you know, someone with some crypto skills try and figure out if there was any code within this letter, and apparently they concluded that yes, there was a code embedded in multiple letters, one of which said, "I am First Lieutenant Robert Rackshaw." Now, part of me wonders, you know, if you were looking to find Robert Rackshaw's name somewhere in a letter, could you not come up with a code in reverse that would kind of put it in there? So in other words, if that's what you were trying to find out, you might go, oh yeah, here's the code that translates, you know, this letter into his name. So, you know, I don't know if this was something that they totally found randomly, or if they were trying to work backwards and back their way into what they thought was a code that implicates him. But, you know, fascinating story that will never die. I guess later in his life, he had denied this, you know, many times, but later in his life, he didn't, you know, flat out deny being D.B. Cooper. So that's kind of interesting as well.
if I was D.B. Cooper and I was on my deathbed, I don't think I could resist spilling the beans, because what's the harm at that point?
Yeah, to me, it's like being deep throat. Well, of course, 40 years after Watergate, you're going to go, hey, it was me.
Yeah.
I mean, I think most reasonable people would do that.
Yeah, so I don't know. I guess we'll never really know.
No, I don't think we will either, which is too bad. So, but it's a fun story nonetheless.
Yes.
I've got one more interesting little add-on to that, though, that has to do with my dad, who was the airline pilot.
Yeah.
Back in the 90s, because my dad was also a skydiver. And there was a 727 that was used at several large skydive events where you could actually jump out the air stair door out the back.
Hmm.
And so they'd take, 50, 80 people on the airplane, and they'd open the door, open the stairs, and everybody just pile out of there, and you got to be your own little D.B. Cooper, basically. You actually got a certificate for making a D.B. Cooper jump. So
that's a riot.
That's pretty cool stuff for sure.
Did they hand you a small bag of money just before you jumped out?
Yeah,
that's a good. Yeah, that would be the way to do it.
$200,000 in play money would be hysterical.
Yeah, there you go, Monopoly money.
Hey, by the way, just back to Lieutenant Rackshaw, the alleged D.B. Cooper. I had forgotten this part of the story, but down at the bottom here, it mentions that he was acquitted of murder and charges and made bail on fraud charges. And later he faked his death pretending to crash his plane into the ocean here in Monterey Bay, California, which is just a few miles from where I'm located. So he had a checkered past, which kind of lets you believe that, if he's willing to do this kind of stuff, he might have been willing to, to do that as D.B. Cooper.
Yeah, exactly. It also occurs to me we might have some listeners who don't understand the concept of that rear exit on the 727. It has the kind of doorways that you're used to on an airplane, but the 727 also had that rear stairs. So basically, it lowered down on in the tail section, and that was a entrance and exit to the aircraft. It was low enough to the ground that, as I recall, didn't require any other ground support equipment.
Yeah, that's my recollection. I remember using it a few times back in the day as a kid, and I just thought it was pretty cool. I just always thought it was a really neat feature of the airplane.
Yes, very unique. One last item. Oh, this is unique. Speaking about unique, I don't know if you all have been in Japanese hotels, but the rooms tend to be really small. There's usually not a lot of extra space in these rooms. But somehow, the Haneda Excel Hotel Tokyo has found room for a flight simulator.
Yeah, and this is kind of interesting. This is not at the main international airport at Narita, which is where people would typically fly into if they were coming into Japan. But this is more of the kind of the domestic airport, if you will. If you're in Tokyo and you're flying domestically, they've got relatively few international flights to this airport. But yeah, there's a great picture here. And I would imagine it must be a wide angle lens because the room looks like it's pretty small. But you see a normal single bed, right? It's not even twin size. It's your basic small bed, small round table, and then the entire wall beyond it, and literally it looks like it's probably no more than 3 feet from the side of the bed, is a full-size 747 cockpit simulator. So you can see the pilot and the co-pilot seats, and you've got all the switches above and instruments in front of you. And as I was reading about this, I thought, oh, this is great. This would be fun, to go in there and just sit and play with it all night long until some 747 time. Lo and behold, it turns out that they have it behind some acrylic, so kind of see-through glass, though you can actually arrange at additional costs to get to log some time in the simulator, but you have to pay for that and for the instructor separately, and it kind of rivals the cost of the room. So, you get to sleep there next to it, but if you want to pay extra, you can actually fly it and actually touch it then.
Wow. What a way to have fun in Tokyo.
It's a great fun story.
And then we have a little something from Launchpad Merzari about AirVenture Oshkosh coming up. So let's listen to Launchpad.
Hey, listeners, your reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari here. If you're going to be at Oshkosh on Wednesday the 24th, you're invited to Potapalooza at the Pipistrel booth on Celebration Way, booth 86. We'll have pizza, gifts, we're giving away an Icon radio, headsets, and lots of other great stuff for you. And we'll feed you, and you can meet the voices in your head with all the other podcasters being there. So come on down again Wednesday at 1800 hours, and we'll quit feeding just as the air show starts.
All right. Thanks, Launchpad. And I guess there's going to be some door prizes, an ICOM A16 handheld radio, some headsets, some other items as well. So this will be a great event to attend, the Potapalooza at Oshkosh.
All right. I changed my mind. I guess I'll go to Oshkosh after all.
I know. I'm definitely going next year. I keep saying that. But then I went to Sun and Fun this year, so I'm definitely going to Oshkosh next year.
Then I'm going to hold you to that. I'm gonna make you go to Oshkosh. You got to be there.
I need to meet people like you, Mart, and many others that I've only interacted with either on this podcast or online and have never met face-to-face. I need to make those.
That would be the perfect place to meet people that you have interacted with but haven't met before. That's the place to do it. So it would be awesome.
Absolutely.
The funny thing is I often see people that live here in California only when I go to Oshkosh.
Yes.
And I don't cross paths with them even though they're in, the local Bay Area. But I see them at Oshkosh. It's just bizarre.
Great.
Interesting.
Again, we're speaking with Mart Klepper. Boy, you've had some interesting projects in the past. How did vintage aviation come about?
Well, that's a good question. First off, I'm a bit of a weirdo, so that helps to explain.
You know what's better? Sorry to interrupt. You know what I like more than a weirdo?
A person who will admit they're a weirdo.
Exactly.
Yes. All right. I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
It does feel like we're, we all belong together here today on the show.
It kind of does, doesn't it?
Yeah. You have found your tribe, Mart.
Awesome. I love it. So, I'm just a little bit of a kook, and the challenge there is to control that and keep it from being weird. And so I think I've done a pretty good job of that. But, with Air Pigs was just a unique way of trying to be sort of fun. And interestingly, if you remember, the Air Pigs logo is actually – it's a flying pig, but he really looks a lot like the Rocketeer.
Yes.
Because I love that movie, The Rocketeer, and that whole era. And then, but to give you an idea of where Vintage Aviation, the print magazine, came from, it actually started with, I don't know if you're familiar with the Plane Savers series that Mikey McBrien from Buffalo Airways was doing on YouTube, where he took a DC-3 that had been used in D-Day, but then had been sitting derelict in Canada for 27 years or so, and he took a fairly short period of time and used their resources of experience and parts in the DC-3 world, because they operate a bunch of them way up in the Northwest Territory where they're normally at. And so anyway, he had this YouTube series, and I created a video, basically a little history lesson on Donald Douglas to help, because the first 2 months or so of his series was all leading up to eventually getting to the airplane and starting this restoration or a refurbishment project to get the airplane back in the air, which they did. And the whole intent was they wanted to fly it on June 6th, the anniversary of D-Day. So just, a couple months little over a month ago, they indeed did get the airplane done. But the Vintage Aviation connection here is that I produced this. I did the research and found the images and wrote a script and did the narration and put together this 8-minute history lesson on Donald Douglas, which mostly became a history lesson on the lineage of aircraft that he had been involved with and the working for others and early in his career and then his own company. And it turned out really well. And I thought, I'm kind of good at this, I think. And I love research. That's what I really enjoyed about Air Pigs, was doing research. I like to get things accurate to the best of my ability. I enjoy that part of it. so I had that under my belt. And then also on Facebook, in a group on Facebook, somebody posted a picture of their father as a Boeing Stratocruiser captain for Northwest. And so this is a real picture from back in the day. And he's leaning out, and I believe it may have been his wife taking the picture down there on the ramp. And it was just such a cool vintage image. And it really struck me. And when the two of those came together, the idea that I enjoy aviation history and research and telling a story, and then I saw that image and I thought, you know what? It just, that looks like a cover of a magazine to me, is what I thought. Of course, what you do then in the next hour is you turn to the computer and you make a cover of the magazine, you know, and give it a name. And the name that struck me was Vintage Aviation. And so then I started looking for other images and creating a bunch of mock covers to see. And I thought, man, this just looks fantastic. And then I kind of came up with what I envisioned it to be. And one of the unique elements here is that it's designed to use all historical images. That's the term I'm using. It's basically, there's no modern images. They're all images from the actual time period. And the time period I've selected for this to represent is from 1900 to 1960. So that's kind of the basic idea and how it came to be. And of course, at the moment, it's really just a concept. I've got a Kickstarter campaign up for it and trying to raise some money to be able to do the premier issue. And I've got some skills when it comes to graphic design, and I've done some magazine work. And so it's not, I'm not in over my head that way, but I definitely need financial support. So that's where the Kickstarter campaign comes in.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about, you know, your experience with this kind of medium. But you have that.
I've been playing around with graphics for a long time in the print side of it as well. And, of course, I learned a lot in the 6 years or so that I was active doing AirPigs in general graphic design. But it's not quite the same thing when it comes to print. And then I did produce a once-a-year magazine for a music event up in South Bend, Indiana. And so I did that for several years, and that gave me the experience of, as a single individual, I would take ads that were produced by agencies, I would create some ads, and then I generated some content for this magazine, and then I put it all together, doing all the design and layout, and then prepped all of the files for the printer, and then delivered to the printer, and saw that process through. So basically, I've encapsulated the entire experience in the past as part of my skill set. And so doing a print magazine now is not any, there's no part of it that I don't understand. And my skills continue to get better, and I continue to study how other people are doing things that I think look great, and you use those things for inspiration. And so I think I'm more than capable of producing a really great quality product. And one of the reasons, and it shows in the Kickstarter video, because I bring up the fact that I just recently did this 1959 Piper Super Cub restoration. And I don't have a huge amount of restoration experience. In fact, I've never done a full restoration until that airplane. I've done some small work here and there, but that airplane turned out fantastic. And I'm not trying to pat myself on the back. I can't hardly believe how beautiful the airplane turned out and how well it fulfilled the vision that I had for it. And a large part of that was the visual presentation of the airplane. And that's what a magazine is. A magazine is a visual presentation. So I believe that I can come up with some great ideas and, you know, using the inspiration of other people's work, which is what we all do. I mean, that's, you know, maybe there's 1% of people who can just literally create great ideas out of nothing. But most of us, we're using, you know, inspiration from other sources and such. So anyway, the restoration project, I think, points to the fact that I can do the research and learn how to do anything I don't know how to do. And hopefully I can create something that's visually appealing. And then, of course, the ultimate point is to entertain and educate with aviation history. And I feel like there's a market for that. But to be honest, the Kickstarter campaign, I've got 19 days left as of the time we're recording this. And it started off really strong, but it's been quite flat here now for several days. And I'm pretty far short of the goal. So I don't know that I'm going to make it on the because you have to hit the goal to get any of the money.
Right.
So, which I think is a great way that Kickstarter works. I mean, I love it. And but the bottom line is, if I don't reach that goal, then, well, it's like nothing happened, and because nothing will happen. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, whether or not. Now, I am going to be up at Oshkosh, though, with a booth in the fly market area, not in the primary, not in the super high rent buildings, but in the fly market. And I've got some ideas that I think are going to work that will give it some pretty big visual impact. So I think I can at least attract, you know, a fair amount of attention with the booth. And then hopefully, you know, I think part of it is being able to talk face to face with people would help anyway, and getting them to better understand my vision and maybe my enthusiasm, you know, for the project, which hopefully is hopefully it's contagious, but I guess we'll see.
So do you anticipate that for a particular issue, would it feature a single airplane, or it can be comprised of a collection of articles, each about a different airplane? And
it'd be a collection of articles. And this is one area that I think that this is another thing that makes me a weirdo. And I learned this actually very young, that me and my dad were not normal within the aviation community. And that is that we have an extremely broad interest of aviation. And most of the people we interacted with had a very they were just running down one channel of aviation. You know, like we had the skydiving world and the sailplane world, and there was the vintage airplane world and the home-built airplane world, and then there were airline pilots. But those people rarely talked to each other. They just stayed within their own group of people. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But we weren't like that. We were interested in all of those groups, and we participated in all of them. And so that's how I see the vision for the magazine, is it's just a reflection of my interest in essentially every aspect of aviation. And in that time period, it would include, you know, the early pioneers, both of the aircraft and then the pioneers that are pilots. It would include World War One and barnstorming and the genesis of the airline era, and then into World War Two, and then the airlines matured significantly after the war, and then even all the way up to 1960, then you have the rapid advancements that we had in aerospace. And my focus isn't so much on aerospace, but I've picked that time span, so I definitely would cover elements of that. So then the goal here is, as it's initially designed, it's a 68-page magazine on heavy, high-quality paper, and either very little or no advertising. I haven't nailed down exactly which it's going to be, but it's not like a typical magazine. It's going to have more content than it is advertising. And again, it may not have any advertising. And then so I envision at least 6 in-depth articles in the issue. And to clarify, the Kickstarter campaign is really, it's only for the premier issue, the single issue to launch the idea. If that happens to be successful, then I would come back to Kickstarter and try to do a campaign where we do in 2020, I'd want to put out 4 issues of the magazine. So it'd be a quarterly, and you'd actually be buying into a subscription at that point. But for right now, it's literally just to launch this one singular issue. And of course, I've got some T-shirts and hats and things like that that you can also buy into at higher levels. But for $15, you can get that premier issue and some stickers. And that then is your support to help make the whole thing happen and to try to launch this concept. But again, if we don't get enough people, then there won't be a magazine at all. So be interesting to see from that standpoint. But I like the idea of covering also airships and rotorcraft, which can certainly be helicopters, but also autogyros were a pretty big thing back in the 30s, you know, or they were trying to be a big thing anyway. And so, and there's a lot of great imagery of that I think would be fascinating. And that's the big challenge. And this is the, on one hand, it's a challenge, but I think it is a gold mine of images. There is a gold mine of images out there that we've reached a point where they're kind of forgotten. There's not much value to them in the modern world. And yet, I think that once they are given the light of day, I think people will realize they have immense value, especially if they're high quality images. You know, they have to be high resolution and they have to be compelling, either the story they're telling or the way that they're formatted and such. And I do believe that there's plenty out there to create a really compelling publication that's not just about the images, though. It would be very much educational and entertaining, in-depth stories and such. So that's kind of my vision. And I don't know if it sounds interesting or not, but it sure does to me.
Yeah, it sounds to me interesting to me as well. As for the images, are these the kinds of things that are in the public domain, or, you know, the copy just available to be used, or will you have to chase down copyright holders and get involved in all of that?
From what I can tell, yeah, there certainly is a large amount that's in the public domain, and any images that were done by the military are in the public domain.
Right, sure.
So there's a huge resource there. And then I think at this point in my research and understanding, I think there's a lot of images that technically whoever originally owned the rights to them has probably long since passed. So it kind of boils down to that the person who owns some form of rights is the one who has the copy, the, you know, an actual high resolution copy. And they then, I may have to license from them because they actually have it in their possession, because there is no trail for most of these images, from what I can tell, as to who really did own, you know, who took the photograph. You know, well, that person's passed years ago, and, you know, there's the images that I'm talking about aren't necessarily historic images. They're just from history. You know, they're not ones that have a big story behind them already, where you might know who the photographer was and somebody is, you know, the family has retained those rights and such. It's not likely to be so much that case. But there's a lot of museums that have huge collections, you know, that they've acquired from people donating to them over time. And in many cases, those have to be licensed from them because, well, it's in their physical possession. They've got some sort of right to it, you know. But they typically don't have a really high fee to be able to have access to those, even from a publishing perspective. But I still have a lot of sources to come up with, but I have a few already in place that tell me that I can absolutely produce this premiere issue with no troubles whatsoever. And if I get to that point, I think it will swing the doors open, you know, with a variety of people being interested in what I'm doing and wanting to help. And in fact, I've seen some of that already, where I've gotten some really great support to make some images available because they think it's a great idea.
Now, Mart, I know that to this point anyway, you've produced a couple of episodes of, I guess you'd call it kind of a companion podcast.
Yeah, so I call it desperate in a way, trying to, you know, get the word out. And I used to do some podcasting with AirPig, so I thought, well, I'm not afraid of that. And as you can really well tell, I do like to talk. So that works out pretty well if you want to do a podcast. So, I think I do have a pretty broad knowledge, you know, that's interesting and potentially entertaining. So I just recorded the third episode a couple nights ago, and I've still got the editing to do. So yeah, we'll see. It's kind of interesting. I mean, I do really enjoy creating the podcasts, but I really do need the whole vintage aviation thing to create some sustainable income. And so I'm not sure what will happen. If the Kickstarter doesn't work, it'll be interesting to see whether I continue on. I could see that I might continue on even though I don't want to. That sounds kind of funny, but because it is so enjoyable to talk to people about the things that I'm passionate about, that they are too, you know, vintage aviation, which can mean so many things. And I do think I've got a great logo for, I mean, it's a simple logo, but I think it's a truly a publication oriented logo for the magazine or however I would use it. So I guess we'll see, but I do enjoy the whole podcasting thing.
Yeah. Oh, that's exciting. It's kind of an adventure, another Mark Klepper adventure. you know, hopefully we'll see some success associated with it.
That'd be nice. Yeah, you'll have to talk to my wife about the Mark Klepper adventures because, oh my goodness, it's just a constant stream.
Oh, dear. All right. So. And we'll put a link to the Kickstarter campaign in the show notes. But you're also up on a Facebook page, correct?
Yeah. So I started a Facebook page, and then there's also a Twitter page and an Instagram. Although, to be honest, I haven't really quite figured out the point of Instagram. So that's not meant to offend the people who think Instagram is the greatest thing. I am very happy for you, but I am still struggling to understand its value. But Twitter is awesome, and Facebook. So I've got Vintage Av Mag. That name is used across all of those platforms. And then I also have VintageAvMag.com, but there's no actual website up. That would be where eventually you'd be able to subscribe to the magazine and get some basic info. But one of the interesting aspects to this is I don't have any interest in providing this publication in the digital realm. I want it to be paper. I want it to be tactile. I want it to be something you hold in your hands. And you don't need batteries. You don't need to be charged, you know. And you don't ever have to worry about a pop-up coming up or getting in the way or some crazy thing. I love print. And I use digital all the time. I'm not against digital. It's fantastic. But I also still love print. And so I think I absolutely think there's value in print. And I think that we take what's on the printed page as being more important. That's the one takeaway I have from this 20 years or so that we have now of digital publications and such. There just seems to be something more serious and important and lasting to the idea of something that's printed on a piece of paper.
It has more of a permanence to it than you'd associate with something that's strictly in the digital domain.
Which I don't know that you can really graph that out because the digital things will be around possibly even longer because they're easy to store and all that. But there's just that innate sense, I think. And I don't know, maybe that's because we're older, you know, and we come from a different era. I don't know. But the way you see some of the younger people, though, embracing some of the older technologies, you know, vinyl records as an example, they seem, I mean, there's a fairly large faction that is passionate about that. They actually see it as being superior to the digital aspects. And so I think that maybe print has its opportunity to, you know, at least reach some form of an audience. And there's been this idea that print is dead. Well, the printers who are printing millions of magazines a year in the United States would probably argue against the idea that print is dead. Now, it is changed. It's beaten up. It's bruised and a little bloody from digital. Yeah. But it's not gone away, and it is never going to go away. So this is just my way of trying to embrace something that I think is a little more valuable and unique. And again, I'm just passionate about print. I know there are many people like that, and there's many people who aren't. So, but this is a niche magazine. It's never meant to be, you know, it's, and aviation is a niche to begin with. Even the legacy magazines within aviation are still pretty small compared to, you know, mainstream publications. And then Vintage Aviation is never meant to be, you know, any more than just a small percentage of those magazines as far as its reach and such. But
sure. And I think the specialist market is a good one for something like this. I subscribe to it's a photography magazine. It's called Lenswork.
Okay.
And it's kind of similar in that it's very high quality printing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's targeted to a specific, very narrow audience, and they've been publishing this for years and years and years. And
I see.
It, you know, for the right audience, it is perfect. And
yeah, sure,
you know,
awesome.
They have some other products that are associated with it. They sell, they'll sell prints and things from the photographers who are featured. But I have to say it's a success, a commercial success, because it's been around for, gosh, I don't know. I think I've subscribed to that thing for at least 20 years.
Is that right?
And yeah, that's
very cool.
So, I mean, I can envision something that's, you know, similar, you know, in this realm, vintage aviation, being, you know, very high quality, great content, printed really well, something that you would want to keep, not just read and then just toss in the recycle bin afterwards.
Right.
So I think, some real possibilities.
I think it's a viable idea. I think the hinge pin is going to be if I can reach the people that have that common interest. I'm pretty sure they're out there, but again, not in massive quantities, but I don't need massive quantities. But the challenge is going to be actually connecting with them.
Yes.
Thus far, I'm not sure that I'm doing a very good job of connecting with them. So we'll see if I can do that before this campaign is up. And, you know, just because if the campaign fails doesn't necessarily mean that I can't still try to find another path or even the same Kickstarter path with a different approach in the future. But it's hard to say, though, because I'll feel a little beat up, you know, if it doesn't succeed. So and I'll go off into the corner and cry for a little bit and then come up with another idea, probably.
But, all right. So. I'm sure. All right. Well, great. Thanks, Mart. And again, we'll put a link in the show notes to the Kickstarter campaign, as well as the podcast. Well, I subscribe to it just through my app, through Pocket Casts. So it's up on iTunes, I assume.
It is. It's on iTunes and Overcast, I think, is a pretty popular thing these days, if I understand that right. It's on Overcast, and it's hosted on SoundCloud, so you can definitely find it there on SoundCloud. And so if you just Vintage Aviation Podcast, if somebody's looking, I think if you just probably by now, if you just Google that, it'll lead you to some form of a link. And and thanks for so much for, one, the opportunity to talk about the magazine, but also I just really enjoyed talking about the news stories and interacting with you guys. It's just awesome.
Yeah, and it's great to have you back on the show. It just feels like it's been too long, Mart, so we'll have to make sure it's not so long till the next
time. Anytime. As I said, I love to talk, so.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, we don't too often have corrections on this podcast, and it's not because we're that good, but in any event, from time to time, we do have a little mistake, and we want to correct something that Launchpad Marzari presented last episode, so here he is.
I have a correction. Bad news. I was wrong about this weekend being the last Red Bull Air race. Good news. There's one more race in Chiba, Japan, September 7th and 8th, and the Japanese air race is always the biggest on the calendar. Bad news. Red Bull says it's already sold out completely, so the only tickets are at scalper prices. Good news, you can watch it live on Red Bull TV for free, just like you did this weekend. Bad news, friend of the podcast Michael Goulian failed to get into the final four, but we'll be rooting for him again in Japan. Good news, this week's race was really exciting with 2018 Grand Champion Martin Shanka leading the race with over 3 seconds in the lead, and on the last lap through the course, he clipped a pylon with a wing, and he went from first to fourth. Oh well, it was exciting. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari.
All right, thanks, Launchpad. What's up with the geeks? Max Trescott, what do you have for us this time?
Well, let me give you a quick preview of Aviation News Talk podcast for this week. I'm going to be talking about Get There-itis, also known as Get Home-itis, or, there was another term I forget that's less popular. But even though it's kind of an odd term, it's a pretty serious problem in general aviation. It's even in Wikipedia. They say it's the determination of a pilot to reach a destination even when conditions for flying are very dangerous. And so years ago, I read about Get There-itis, and I thought, oh, I know about that. That'll never happen to me. And
guess what? Lo and behold, it actually did. So I tell the story of how back when I was a 300-hour pilot, I went plowing ahead through a really nasty storm, mainly because I had a crying 3-year-old daughter next to me. And literally the entire way, all I could think of was, how do I get home as quickly and most directly as possible? Now, the reason I picked this up as a topic was, there was a story I posted last week on Facebook, which probably got more comments than just about anything I've ever posted. And that was a clear case of get there-itis with a gentleman in Colorado who took off at night in the mountains, in clouds with his family. It wasn't instrument rated. Of course, that turned out very badly. So I'll be talking about all different forms of get there-itis in episode 114 of the Aviation News Talk podcast. And then I just wanted to make a real quick shout out. I learned just before we started to record here today that I lost a good friend and fellow CFI, Daryl Kalthoff. He passed away at home, possibly of a heart attack. And I mention this because we have so many listeners. I'm sure that someone here has flown with him in the past. Daryl was about 50 years old, which, of course, is way too young. He also had one of the busiest flight schedules at the West Valley Flying Club in Palo Alto, where I teach. And I always loved Daryl because he's very cheerful and extremely passionate about his approach to flight instruction. So he was just a great guy to interact with and to be around. But I got to tell you, the thing I liked most about him is whenever we had our monthly CFI meetings, he was that one guy that would bring up whatever topic that was the elephant in the room that, you know, perhaps management didn't really want to talk about, but he was just relentless. I mean, he was like a bulldog. He'd bring up the topic and he would just sink his teeth into it and he just wouldn't let go. So anyway, I'm going to miss him very dearly. And I just say for anyone out there who is a CFI or who's maybe thinking about becoming a CFI, I just hope you follow your own inner Daryl and be a little bit more like him. So anyway, Daryl, I'm going to miss you, buddy.
Wow. Yeah, that's really a shame. I'm sorry for that.
Yeah, thanks.
I love people like that, the bulldog who will latch onto something that other people just don't want to deal with or just refuse to recognize and just, you know, very, just won't let it go. Sometimes, I don't know, that's how you sort of expand your understanding of things sometimes when you have someone like that leading the charge. So
yeah, I can exactly
appreciate that. Yeah, cool.
Yep, he was just wonderful on every level. So, and that was just one of the things that I think everybody kind of knew if we were in a meeting. It's like, oh, and what's Daryl going to say? Because he always said what you had on your mind, but you weren't willing to really quite vocalize. So.
Wow. All right. This past weekend, I attended the Geneseo Air Show put on by the National Warplane Museum. Mart, you would have really enjoyed this show, I think. It's pretty much completely devoted to warbirds, primarily
nice.
World War II and earlier. There was, I think, just one jet there. Just one jet, and that was the A-10 demo team was there, which was, nice. Yeah, really exciting because I had only seen A-10s fly overhead back when the National Guard up at Bradley Airport flew those, but that was it. So it was really, really enjoyable to see this Warthog maneuvering at, well, you know, faster speeds than a prop plane, but mm-hmm. not at what you'd expect from a, you know, an F-16 or an F-22 or 35 or something like that. It was pretty impressive. But otherwise, some C-47s, B-17, B-25. Champagne Gal was there from the Champagne Aviation Museum in Ohio. And let's see, what else? Some older biplanes, Stinsons, I guess. Just a whole variety of things. There were also some aerobatic performances. And, of course, let's see, the sailplane. That was just spectacular, too. So it was a great show. There were some of our listeners were there as well, but unfortunately we didn't get connected during the day, either on Saturday or Sunday. So that was kind of unfortunate, but it was a great time. And that part of New York State has got some just really amazing attractions. I spent a lot of time at the Corning Glass Museum, which is, I hate to say this, even compared to all the aviation museums I love, this just might be one of the best museums out there. These days, it's really well done.
And Max, I got to tell you, I grew up really close to that museum, and I remember visiting it as a kid. And I think the thing that still sticks out in my mind is that huge, what is it, 200-inch telescope wafer that they built. Yes. That weighs, I don't know, like 10 tons. I mean, what a massive, massive piece of glass. So, yes, some phenomenal engineering has come out of Corning, including Gorilla Glass.
Yes.
Everyone who carries around an iPhone, that comes straight out of Corning, New York.
That's right. That's right. And they have a lot of demonstrations there as well during the day, glass blowing as well as creating other works of art out of glass. It, really fascinating. And Letchworth State Park is also in that area, which is just phenomenal. Lots of waterfalls and just beautiful scenery. So it makes for a nice family vacation, actually, for those that might be able to get to that area with your family, do the air show, and then do some of these other attractions in the area. And, you know, it'll be great fun for the family. So that was my weekend. All right. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, our guest this episode was Mart Klupper. And Mart, we'll have some links in the show notes, of course, but again, tell our listeners where they can find you or Vintage Aviation online.
Yeah, well, the Kickstarter campaign, which runs through August 3rd of this year, is if you just go to Kickstarter.com and search on Vintage Aviation, you'll find it for sure. I did create a little tiny URL.com/VintageAvMag. That link will redirect you right to the Kickstarter page, or you can find it on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under the Vintage Av Mag name.
Great. Thanks again for joining us. Always good to talk to you.
It's great talking to you guys. I really appreciate it.
And you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/561. If you want to send us email, just send it to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Be sure to look for us on Twitter and Facebook. And Max Trescott, where do we find you online?
Well, the usual places, you could just Google Max Trescott, but probably the easiest thing to do is to head out to aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact at the top of the page, and you can shoot me an email. You'll find my other contact information there as well. If you're interested in Cirrus aircraft or thinking about buying one, definitely call me. You'll find my phone number there. A lot I can do to help people who are thinking about buying either a new or a used Cirrus. So if that's you, contact me immediately. And then there's also a link there for leaving listener questions for the Aviation News Talk podcast.
Cool. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. You can find me on LinkedIn, also at the UAVDigest.com, talking about unmanned aviation, and at PaxXPodcast.com, talking about the passenger experience. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. As always, you can visit brunomassone.com, find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds. And so please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Hey, and thanks for listening. £43,500 of thrust, and that's what stuck in my mind, because that world record is at something 132,000 or some such thrust, and it's just like, wow, what a difference, because it was earth shattering when the JT9D was available.
Yes, so. We've come a long way.
Boy, I'll say, yeah,
yeah.
So yeah, and I thought you might appreciate that. Where, like, when did you start at Pratt & Whitney?
I started in 78.
Okay.
And so, yeah, those were the JT9 or the JT8D in the 90 heydays.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
And then, of course, later on, the PW2000 came along for the 757 and then the PW4000.
And it's funny, you know, I didn't pay that much attention in the later years as to what either any of the manufacturers were doing, at least when it came to the actual numbers and such. So, but as a kid, it's really weird that I was just obsessed with the details of things like the engines on the 747. So,
yes.
And my dad loved that airplane. Man, oh man, he just, you know, I think the Uniteds were all the ones he flew were, I think, Dash 200s.
Okay.
And so they were early airplanes and, you know, no glass cockpits, and they had the INSs for navigation. And but he just loved that airplane, and he loved to hand fly it as often as he could.
Fantastic. So, good, yeah. Really,
he got over 10,000 hours in 747.
Wow.
Anyway, so I'm just rattling on here. If I'm distracting.
No, that's fine. No. Max T, are you there?
I am here. How are you doing?
Good. Say hello to Mart.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Well, I'm a little delayed here. I'm not as well as I'd like to be. I just learned a few minutes ago that a fellow flight instructor died on Friday.
Of a
heart attack, you know, at home. I was like, whoa, here's a guy that I pass in the hall, you know, every day and a good friend to talk to. And it's like, damn. The guy is like maybe 50, you know, it's just.
I see. Yeah.
50.
It's not fair. You know, it just.
Yes.
Anyway, so I'm on my rant.
Sorry.
I mean, Max knows I lost a client in an accident 2 months ago. So it's all like, right. Oh, geez. You know, having losing two people who are friends at the same club, you know, such a short period of time. It's just driving me crazy this afternoon.
Yeah.
Tough to deal with for sure.
Indeed.
I think that's the hardest part of getting old is.
It is.
People you know are, you know, die, and sometimes they're just friends, sometimes they're family.
Yep.
But it's just, I don't know. The only, you know, and now that since I'm retired, I think that 90% of the time when I wear my suit is going to a funeral.
Yeah, that's tough. Yeah, I was commenting to my wife that I always heard as you get older, you know, you end up losing friends. But I was thinking, I guess that's probably better than the alternative, which is having my friends lose somebody who's younger.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, well, so count my blessings.
Yeah. That happened. My grandfather lived into the 90s, and he was kind of depressed towards the end of his life because just exactly what you said, Max, all of his friends had, you know, had died. He had no friends left. They all died.
Yeah. And I certainly have found that as I get older, you know, I just don't make friends like I used to. It's like, yeah, the people from the early parts of our lives, but, you know, later on, yeah, it's like, do you really go out when you're in your 60s and find new friends? It's like, especially younger ones that are going to be around.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you for letting me.
All right.
Just found out a half hour ago and I'm still wrapped around
the
axle.
Boy.
Yeah,
for sure.
Very sorry.
Yeah.
I've met you before, Max T, but I used to do air pigs, so I don't know if that rings a bell with you at all.
No, remind me where we've met before. I
don't
recall.
Up at Oshkosh. Like,
okay.
I've seen you like in some of the podcasting environments up there. And I don't know that we've ever actually had a conversation or an in-depth conversation, but
okay.
I used to do the Air Pigs blog, which was just it partially tongue-in-cheek or a very loose, fun kind of aviation blog. Mm-hmm. And but it's been hibernating for a while. And then so I rebuilt an airplane in the last year and a half or 2 years,
nice.
Basically. And then so now I'm trying the magazine thing. So
that's great. Anyway. That's fantastic. Yeah, I did a lot of running around at Oshkosh for a number of years with a camera crew and a microphone and golf cart, and that was great fun. So I ended up meeting tons of people, you know, at every show as I was zipping in and out of all the exhibit halls and things like that. But
there are a lot of people there.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's
true.
Hard to remember them.
Hard to remember all of them, yes. And I still have my Air Pigs t-shirt.
Ah, very good.
Yeah.
Nice. Wow. Yeah.
I mean, I still wear it, too.
And is, am I right, though, that you've never been to Oshkosh still?
That's correct.
So that can't be. That's just not possible.
I know. Well,
it's just wrong, too.
I know it is.
So there's that, too, yes.
So I did go to Sun and Fun this year. That was my first time there.
It's your first time there? Okay.
Yeah, so I thought I'd start small.
Yeah, I haven't been to Sun and Fun for a while, and it's fine and dandy, but oh my goodness.
Oh, it is. You know,
I was at Oshkosh in 1970, the very first year, as a 9-year-old.
My gosh.
And and I've only missed about 8 of them in the entire 50 years now of Oshkosh.
In the Midwest somewhere?
Yeah, I'm in Indiana. So
okay, that was my guess.
makes it fairly easy.
Yeah, it's a big difference if you're on, you know, the coast, which is Absolutely. Where I've always lived, the East Coast or the West Coast. It's,
sure.
it's a long way, no matter, you know, where
exactly.
you are.
Exactly. Yeah, no, there's no doubt that makes a difference. And then my dad was a pilot for United, so when...
Yeah, I heard you talking about that. 10,000 hours in the 47. What a wonderful gig.
Yeah, and I was going to explain real quick on that he came online when the airplane, like 6 months after the airplane came online, of course, as a co-pilot, but he stayed in the co-pilot seat until he had enough seniority to actually become a captain. So he never went over to the DC-10, which was the standard thing at United. You'd move up to a DC-10 captain, and then eventually you'd work your way back to being a 747 captain.
He loved the airplane that much.
He loved the airplane.
Good
and
for him.
He lived in Indiana and driving to O'Hare, it was a 3-hour trip. And so as the senior co-pilot, he could fly to Hawaii, which was just one trip a week. So it minimized the number of times he had to drive up to Chicago. So that's another reason why he liked being the most senior co-pilot until he finally had enough seniority to just move over seat there. So anyway,
that's great.
Had quite a career there at United. So
yeah.
Anyway. And he passed away in 2009. So
oh, did he? I was going to ask you actually if he was still with us.
No. In fact, it was shortly after I started Air Pigs because that was in late 2008, and just a couple months later, then he suddenly got ill and was gone. At 79 years old.
Yeah. Wow. Sorry.
Again. Too young.
Yes. Yep. All right.
Well, good. All right, gentlemen, let's make a pact, the three of us. We're going to stick it out to age 100, okay? Right here now.
It's a great plan.
This is a blood brother pact, all right? Are you guys with me or what?
If I make it to 100, I'm going to go to one of those, you know, those homes where, you know, assisted living or whatever. Because if I make it to 100, I don't know if you've ever been to one of those homes, but it's all women.
You're right.
The men have all died off.
Yeah,
so it'd be me and all these women. That sounds like heaven.
I'm thinking of going to one right now. Why is it I'm in a profession where 95% of the people are men? It's like I constantly ask men. And I ran it. I saw a comment in a podcasting forum. This was in Dave Jackson's forum. And he said something about looking for podcasts that were predominantly women. Which, you know, Glenn the Geek pops in there, Horse Radio Network. Yep. 95% of my listeners are women. I just thought, damn, what the heck did I do wrong?
Well, I remember when I was in engineering school, I used to take a lot of elective courses over at the liberal arts college. And all my engineering friends who would take their electives and sort of, you know, sciencey kinds of things that engineers would like would ask me, what are you doing over there on the liberal arts campus?
You're a smart young man.
Yeah, it's like, that's where the women are, you morons.
Yes. Duh. Exactly.
Hey, there you go.
Those of us who were engineers were morons back then. That's all I can say.
That's right.
But of course, the top person in my engineering class was a woman. In fact, one of our professors in my program was a woman from the following year, 1 year junior to me. So,
What year did you graduate from college?
78 and 79. I stayed for 2 years because I started engineering a year late. So I got my psych degree in 78, my engineering degree in 79.
So I graduated in 76. So I was just a couple of years ahead of you. Yeah. And in those days, there were not a lot of women in engineering.
Yeah. Yep. It was in the single digits for us.
Yes.
Very few women.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and just to put it in perspective, I graduated high school in 79, so I'm a little younger than you guys.
Not that much. I graduated in 74. So.
And then here's my big blunder when it comes to college. So I was accepted at Purdue in engineering, Sure. And but my dad bought this little airport in Indiana in the summer between me graduating high school and starting college. Yeah. And so I elected to become an airport bum instead of a college student. And so I never went. I just didn't show up.
Yeah, you know what? Nothing wrong with that. I always wanted to become a ski bum. I always wished I took a year off. Somewhere in my life. Just hung out, you know, loading people into ski lift chairs and skiing the rest of the time.
It would be good to do both, actually, you know, to take some time off and do the fun stuff, but also to get I should have got the education because it really did close a lot of doors for me, you know, as time went on. So I regret it a little bit, not a lot, just a little bit.
You make all these choices in life, you know, and you never know what the other paths, you know, where they would have taken you. And
that's true.
Right.
You know, they might have been a lot better, whatever better is, or it could be a lot, could have been a lot worse. You just don't know.
Exactly.
You know,
there's no way to know. We just always assume that other path would have been better, but that's not the reality at all.
Yeah, so. I agree.
If only I could have made choices as an 18-year-old with everything I know now. Oh, my God.
Isn't that interesting, though? And it's funny because, you know, when we were younger, we heard people talk like that, but it just didn't even click with us.
But
and now we get there and we're thinking, man, just if I knew now. Then what I know now. So
yes.
No question. When you're 18, you don't have, you're not half as smart as you think you are.
Well, okay. I think you guys will enjoy this. So the difference between high school students and college students. High school students think they know everything. College students know they know everything.
Yeah, that's good. That's accurate, I think.
I'm kind of smiling at that one. I think you're right.
Yeah, I think it's. And then eventually they get smart and realize they don't really know much of anything.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, totally. So. Eventually.
Oh, man. All right. Well, hey, you want to do a show?
Hey, why not?
No, this is fun. What the hell?
This might be half the show right there.
Stick it into the end.
All right.